I'm not all for the engine. What their rates will be determined what their costs, I presume. It could be higher. And I'm sure that, and in fact, the Sigma people stated that there is no such thing as cheap electricity anymore. Even hydropower being developed now is going to be much more expensive than, say, where the rapids were developed for, This is right, your labor and equipment will be the varying factors. Hydro, whereas diesel or other types of plant, you'll have your fuel added to it, but the price of water will be low.
I can just bring into the capital cost of a hydro plant is much, much higher than, say, a diesel generator or a coal fired plant. So that you're having to borrow a large amount of money and you're having to pay interest on it. So the big cost for hydro is the interest on the money to borrow from the entire principal. And for plants of a certain size, it's competitive to pay for coal or what, as rather than pay for those interest.
Do you possibly know what the need is up to the fiber like this?
In White Horse or in Newfoundland?
Well, I don't know how it works. I was in impression it's a little different than the White Horse and Newfoundland.
That's right. It's a little different everywhere in that it was set up to equalize the first 300 kilowatt hours throughout the Yukon. That is, people in Old Crow will pay the same amount for 300 kilowatt hours as people in White Horse. And after that, it has no effect to that.
Well, is there some minimal amount which is charged below the county? Well, I think in fact one has a bill of at least 250 if you don't consume the power at all.
Oh, yes. Minimum bill is 250 in White Horse for residential consumers.
Is there a maximum subsidy of that amount to the consumer?
Yeah, the rebate in, I just run through these if you like, that the rebate in White Horse is $2.60 per month. In Carcross, it's $17.30. In Keno City and Watson Lake, it's $10.80. Beaver Creek, Destruction Bay, Haines Junction, Lower Post, Kelly Crossing, Cross River, Stewart Crossing, Tesla, Upper Yard. It's $24.40.
Now, this figure is the cost of the first 300 kilowatt hours minus 250, is that correct?
No, this is... The 250 is a minimum bill. It doesn't really enter into it unless you use less than $2.50.
Now, how is this... Like,
you know, you said
the window
is 260. How is that to be arrived? It's to equalize your first
300 kilowatt hour. No, how does that arrive in the case of one horse? Is that the cost of 300 kilowatt hours?
No, that's the rebate.
Maybe it was that I do with the state of Iowa, the rebate of the state of Iowa,
The rebate is made up of, Yukon Electrical is an investor-owned utility, and as such pays income tax. The income tax is paid to the federal government, who return 95% of this to, in this case, Yukon territory. In Alberta, they return it to the Alberta government. And the stipulation was that the government it is returned to is to give it back to the consumer in a manner that is approved by the federal government. In Alberta, it's a straight percentage refund on all bills, whether it be power, residential, commercial, or what. in Yukon, it's used to equalize the residential rate. And last year, it was supposed to be a 15% reduction on commercial rates outside of the city of Whitehorse. They have since, the federal government has since decided that government-paid accounts should not receive this rebate, because in effect it was just going around in a circle. So now it is non-government accounts that receive this rebate, residential and commercial. Yeah, that's right, too.
Mr. Wagner, what's the rough ballpark figure that your company's
in? I'm not certain what it was. There's about $2.2 or $3 million in the pot now. And I believe the territorial government wants to keep this in here so that they can, yes, keep it up.
Several years ago in Ontario, the couple of industry did some free money to be established.
I don't think it's really up to, like all the generation of hydropower in the Yukon is to be done by Northern Canada Power Commission. Minister of Indian Affairs made this clear last.
Into
the cost of electricity in the Yukon? Oh, yes. It would enter into the cost of electricity anyway.
Yeah. Don't you think you should be subsidizing hydroelectric power at all you do with the fact that wildfires are raising the cost?
Well, you can get arguments both ways in this. I don't think I'm qualified to answer that. It'll be the Crown Corporation who is developing the hydro site.
So the eventual cost is will be governed by infrastructure. Infrastructure would add to the cost of electricity.
That's right. There's been some talk of developing a large site and having the federal government, you might say, finance the portion of this site that is not required immediately, so that it is not developed in small stages. I think this is up to the people of the Yukon to promote. You know, if this is what they wish to
happen. Fuel oil smoke is a hazard to health. Serious hazard to somebody.
Mr. Armstrong, we're going to be having a kind of a free-for-all in about 10 days' time on the 8th, at which all these things can be discussed. And hopefully we can bring everything together to decide, to get some kind of consensus on these things you're touching on.
This is a comparison again. Example, 100 kilowatt hour in Whitehorse would cost $4.10. The rebate would be $1.60 with a total cost of $2.50. 200 kilowatt would cost $7.60 with a rebate of $2.60, including the customer cost of $5. 300 would be 5010, a rebate of $260, giving the customer a total cost of $750. Susan said here, in car cross now, the first 100 kilowatt cost $1080 with a rebate of $880, giving the customer cost of $2 rather than $250 as in White Horse. I don't believe I have to, too much else on this, unless there's some questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Wagner or Mr. Schieber?
Are there any rate comparisons for the different structures in the city report?
No discussion of rates this evening.
Can you give us some rates for those who are really big consumers of power?
Like and like some lines, what would represent the original one?
Okay, for Watson Lake, for example, for a power service, this would be to Miller. So on, there's a demand charge for each horsepower of billing demand, $1 per horsepower. And then there's an energy charge for the first 50 kilowatt hour used per horsepower of billing demand, is at 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, if the customer had a 100 horse demand, this would mean it would be 5,000, for the first 5,000 kilowatt hour, it would be at 10 cents kilowatt hour. For the next 100 kilowatt, which would mean the next 10,000 kilowatt hour, it would be at 8, and then all excess energy at 5. Now this is a diesel plant, small diesel station. And as you know, we don't or do not supply power to, we supply power to White Horse Copper. And since it's the only customer we supply power to, I'm not at liberty to say what our rate is. Now, I'm sure if you ask them that they would be quite willing to give it to you, but it's not really up to me to disclose where it's only one individual customer. There's general rate, I think it's their own rate. I could ask Mr. Detronich if he had any objection to giving it to you, but I don't feel I'm at liberty.
Could you put that in there and tell me what the difference between a kilo bar and a kilo watt is? What is a reactor?
The reactor is real power, and it's called reactive power. And this is from the inductive or capacitive nature of the circuit.
This is exactly the same thing as the power factor.
Pardon?
This is the same thing as power factor. This is a kilowatt
yes.
equals power factor, or kilobar equals a kilowatt and power factor. Is that correct?
Power factor represents the
phase lag between the watts, or the volts in the.
Well, there's another term that comes in here, is apparent. And as the reactive power changes, the apparent power gets larger. See how it goes larger than the load?
What sort of a load special power requirement, say of a smelter or something like that.
Type of motors they use.
Yeah, motors. Yeah. I guess they would use furnaces. But as far as getting back to this reactor, we need the power. The real power is the only power that's useful. Reactor power you can use. And the higher that becomes, you need a higher paired power for being the real usable power. That's the angle. The angle between these two points. I don't know how to explain it.
They supply everything except about 1.2 megawatt. And our peak last winter was 26. 26. So they would supply 25 megawatt. Actually, they supply most of it. Not if they
continue to
increase. No, it gets down to a bottom step and it stays there, but it is based on year-round use or, you know, continuous use. With electric heat, it is not a year-round use. Very likely will, but if you have to heat your home, it's a case of, is it better to use oil or electricity or wood or whatever? And at the present time, cost-wise, it is just par for oil and electricity. Now, if you're producing power by running water, it's a renewable resource. So therefore, even if it costs a little more, it is probably better to heat your home with electricity than with oil, which is a non-renewable resource.
Well, that's arguing absolute cost of electricity versus oil, whereas I'm talking about the relative cost of electricity, you know, the demand would not be able to
I think electricity is going to be charged for the same as oil and other forms of energy, you know, in relation to what it costs to produce it. And the costs are going up, so the cost of electricity is going up. And we have never suggested that it should be wasted, but it's a case of which is the best way to heat your water or wash your clothes or whatever, heat your house. If, regardless of cost, it shouldn't be assumed that just because it's cheaper to do it, it's the best way. It's what is going to be the best way down the road. Because if the price of oil goes to $20 a barrel, which there is some talk of it doing, you won't be able to stay very warm at home eating with oil.
The idea is if you use the first 300 kilowatts or the first 100 kilowatts are charged at a certain rate, which is higher than the next 200 kilowatts, then the idea is that the more electricity you use, the unit cost lowers. And it's been that trend.
Yes, it is changing in many areas. In the states where they are being hit really hard by fuel costs, they are having what they call a balloon rate on the end, where the top of the rate is based on cost of service, your service to the house, meter, and so on, billing. And then there's a lowering there, and then if you go over that, then it goes back up again.
You mentioned it's a trend right now, but it's very small now.
Yes. We're doing a study now on the utilization of transformers and lines and so on in homes that are electrically heated. And it will require a year to do this to get full impact of what use is made of the equipment during the summer, and we won't know just what our costs are to have this equipment sitting idle or partially used during the summer until we complete this.
I think we should possibly move along now. I'd like to thank very much Mr. Wagner and Mr. Schieber for coming in to speak to us. So we can just break for a moment, and Mr. Alford will start talking about string power. Who's going to speak to us on the streams in the Yukon, streams and rivers of the Yukon.
And how they're measured.
And how they're measured, yes. Monty, I'm not even sure your job title.
Just on a certain time. That's all right.
You're having some...
Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Alford is the officer in charge of water surveys for the Yukon District, which I just found out takes in a good bit of northern British Columbia as well. So with that, we'll pass it over to Mr. Alford.
Yeah, I feel a little like the cart before the horse because I'm taking you all back to square one to go. Without any $200. And since I'm talking basically about the measurement of water, and this should preclude any talk of the development of water, if you put it in the proper order. Just about anyone could speak about water because it's such a vital element, a dominant element. And be speaking of it in a different, totally different discipline. Since water is our most important element, how understandable it is that we should try to learn something about it, to understand it, and in very practical terms, to know exactly how much we have. Hopefully, by the end of my talk, you will have some basic idea of how water information is collected, and how important it is to carry out these critical surveys. The role and responsibility of the Water Survey of Canada is to measure that part of the hydrologic cycle that we can see. I'm referring to surface runoff. There are other sections of the department that are concerned with groundwater survey, glacier survey, and water quality. I'm speaking only of surface runoff, which is my particular interest and my occupation. As a data collecting agency and nothing more, the Water Survey of Canada inventorizes the surface runoff in the Yukon, or out of the White House office, in the Yukon and Northern British Columbia. What we're doing really is measuring the result of precipitation in the form of rain and snow. Now, to provide some historical perspective, the business of measuring stream flow in Canada started at the turn of the century, actually in 1903, on the Bow River in Alberta. The first measurements were carried out and since then, the business of measuring streams and studying lakes has developed so that at the present time, the Water Survey have 5,300 hydrometric stations under study in Canada. Of those 5,300, we're studying 78 out of the White Horse office. About half of those are located in the Yukon, and half, as Bob mentioned, in Northern British Columbia. The surveys in the Yukon started in 1944, so we've been in the business for some time. The first stations were established the Yukon River at Whitehorse and the Yukon River at Dawson. This was followed in 1947 by the establishment of stations on the Tisman River and the Tikini River near Whitehorse, and followed in 1952 by the establishment of stations on the Pelly and the Stuart River at Mayo. And since that time, the network has expanded so that today we have in the Yukon a system, can be seen here on this map. This year we hope to add to this system the establishment of stations on the Hess River, on the Babbage River, which is the stream flowing in. And possibly a station on the Snake River. In addition to measurements of flow, which is our prime responsibility, we are also carrying out studies of lakes in terms of their change in stage. We act as collectors of samples for the Water Quality Division. Since we're in some of these remote areas, we to sort of do a job for them, because it costs us so much money to get to these stations that it seems a shame not to do as much as possible when you're there. In addition to this, we started 2 years ago a program of sediment study. And on seven streams now, we are collecting suspended sediment. So our role is expanding. And with pressure of possible hydro development, our expansion will perhaps accelerate. In addition to this, we assist the glaciology division in the monitoring of glaciers that they happen to be studying, or glaciers that start misbehaving, like the Steele Glacier and the Tweedsmuir, who suddenly decide to pick up their skirts and run. So we, since we're here, help them by monitoring the glacier during its active period. This is done by using methods of terrestrial photogrammetry and aerial photography. Now, why do we do this? Elsewhere in Canada. To the industrialist, to the conservationist, to the water power developer, to the geographer, to the miner, to the biologist, and to the tourist. So all these people want to know something about water, and it's simply the responsibility of the department to provide that information. Going back to, since this is the whole subject, is revolves, the seminars revolve around hydropower. I must, of course, stick to that basic concept. And say that no dam can be built in the most economical manner unless basic facts are known about the stream. And it's very unfortunate that it takes a long time to learn something about a stream. The questions the dam designer wants to know are, first, how high will the river go? What are the high flows, which will determine his spillway capacity? What are the low flows, which will determine just how high he has to build his dam, basically? And in the north, allow for two opposing factors. As Mr. Wagner pointed out, in winter, you have your greatest demand, your greatest load. And it is at that time of year when Yukon streams just about disappear. You have your minimum flows in March and April every year. The streams go from the difference between high flows and low flows is very dramatic in the north. In many cases, particularly when you go into the permafrost from about the Peel River north, you're likely to find the pattern of flows varying by as much as 300 and 400 times. So that you're faced with the tremendous problem of having to provide storage for that winter period. And that is the key to any development of water power in northern regions, is this creation of storage. We're very fortunate here, of course, because, for example, for the White Horse Rapids development, where you have natural storage and a wonderful chain of lakes. But when you start thinking of propelling, you have to think of a considerable amount of storage. This is what makes the Five Fingers Yukon River Farm Acts development rather interesting, while you immediately shy away from it and think, well, good heavens, to damn the cue cards, almost a sacrilegious act. It really doesn't demand much of a reservoir, very small reservoir, because you're using a large amount of water. You don't have to store to acquire that water. The difference between high flows, I like to keep to the Pelly and the Yukon because these seem to be favorites at the moment. And to give you some idea, the difference between summer flows on the Pelly and winter flows, the peak flow in May or June on the Pelly can be anywhere from 140 to 150,000 cubic feet per second. Now that same stream, measured in March or April, will barely yield 2,000 CFS. So we're looking at 1/70 of the summer flow. That's a stream that has no storage, no natural storage whatever. The pattern for the Yukon River, say at Carmax, is a little better because you have the benefit of Lake LaBarge, Marsh Lake, and of course Taggett, all the other lakes behind. Here you have high flows of 120,000 and low flows of about 8,000. So your factor goes to about 15. Again, that makes the Yukon look a little attractive. Now we hear the figure, and particularly in terms of such reports as the Sigma report and other reports, there have been many reports on water paths, certainly. And the terms that you see repeatedly used are firm flow, words firm flow, which mean nothing more than the greatest flow at a site that is available 100% of the time. And this is a figure that the dam designer must play with. It's a function, of course, of storage. It's related to storage that can be created by a dam of X height. And for the Pelly River, this firm flow figure would be about 8,000 cubic feet per second. That's with a low dam, with a gross head of 160 feet, reservoir 95 square miles. For the Yukon River at Carmax, this firm flow figure is somewhere around 7,500 CFS cubic feet per second for a dam of gross head just 80 feet and a reservoir of only 14 square miles. Now, because rivers are like women and behave in sort of curious and unpredictable ways, any study must necessitate a sort of a long-term program. The dam designer, when he approaches you and you give him some stream flow data, any data, of course, is a sort of a tasty morsel to him. But if you can give him 20 years record, he'll take what you give him with a kind of a grin. If you can give him 30 or 40 years record, then he sort of skips away. And this is what we have been able to do in the Yukon. There have been three developments here just in my short time. The Mayo River, Yukon River, and now the Asia. And for two of those projects, we were able to hand over to the designers 15 years flow records. Mind you, this doesn't, this is not the complete thing. This is not the ultimate, because we know, hydrologists know, engineers know, that there are front frequencies of 50, 100 years, we even speak of 1,000 years. When I said that rivers behave in an unpredictable way, I refer, in essence, to the cycles, to the patterns. One may study a stream for many years and still never get, really, anywhere near what this stream is going to put out. You can't sort of build a dam with that very big question mark hanging over your head. Dams are very expensive things, and if your spillway just isn't big enough, next year down comes a whopper, away it goes, which more than pays for any surveys that we may have done for 20 or 30 years. In fact, they would be a drop in the bucket. So we must, particularly in the north, where you have a very strange system, a very distinct difference between summer and winter flows, where you have a very unique pattern due to both topography, geology, existence of permafrost, and climate. The longer you can study a stream, or then the better. 30 years is certainly, we don't pack up at 30 years. We have several streams in the Yukon that we have been studying for close to 30 years now, and we will continue studying. Now going from the why do we do all this? We carry out these surveys to provide basic data. We do it over a long period of time because the rivers behave in a strange way, and we may have to wait many years before we get a high flow. Now, proceeding from the why to the how do we measure this? I mentioned stations, the word station, and I refer to hydrometric stations. And these are places where we do our little bit of work. These are places indicated by the arrows, where we have, where we do two things. We record the height of the river or lake, and we measure, in the case of a river, we measure the volume of flow. And we do this in a number of ways with very unusual instruments and from many different kinds of platforms. In winter, of course, we're able to use the ice. Near the highway, sometimes we can use bridges. At more remote locations, we have to build cableways with little cars on them that allow the chap to swing out over the river and obtain his soundings and his velocity measurements. So these are very expensive installations. One installation that we completed just a couple of years ago cost us $40,000. And that's simply to permit the surveyor go into the station, or went into the station. That doesn't include anything. It doesn't include the helicopter or whatever air expense or whatever expense may be involved in reaching the station. Just to permit him to make these surveys. So they become very, very expensive. So at these locations, at these hydrometric stations, two things are done. A measurement of stream flow is made, and the level of the river, in relation to some fixed point, a benchmark, is established. And when he does this, he takes this information and he plots it to make a graph. And this is called the rating curve for the particular river. And it is the establishment of this curve and the sort of checking of it from year to year to year to year. That's our prime function. Using this curve, this rating curve for any stream, in conjunction with gauge heights, that is changes in that water level, which are recorded either manually by someone looking at a simple marked stick to a very complex automatic recorder that costs $4,000 or $5,000. Using the information, those gauge heights, we're able to go to this rating curve, and for every day, the manual gauges are usually read daily. The automatic recorders, of course, are continuous. We have, out of the White Horse office, 60 automatics clicking away all out of the wilderness. And they're making a line on a chart that looks something like this. This is the Pelly River, Pelly Crossing. This is what the river is doing in terms of... No, it's all right. So, using this, having this record of change of water level, and then using this rating curve that has been established by the surveyors, we're able to pick off daily discharges. These are the figures that all these people are interested in, the dam designer and all the other people. And we publish those annually in a book. The processes involved between, and that's all. It's really quite a simple operation. But the problems encountered in performing this very simple operation are many. Particularly in a northern environment. What you saw then here is, I don't quite help that out, that's a rating curve for the Pelly River. It's a simple curve of parabolic order, and it's a fairly stable one, and actually provides us with a very good printout, computer printout for the Pelly River. What happens is, just to run through briefly the process, when we have this recorder, we strip the recorder of its chart, and then we code this and prepare index cards for the computer. This goes to Vancouver, it's run through the computer at UBC, and we get back a computer printout. Computer printout with daily discharges for that particular stream, in this case the Pelly. In addition to obtaining that information, the daily flows, we prepare hydrographs of the various streams. This emphasizes rather well the tremendous difference in flow characteristics between summer and winter. For the Porcupine River at Oak Crow, these are months here, going along the top, and this way down here, this almost flat line along the bottom, is what happens in winter. And then bang, the river goes out, and immediately you have all the snow, snow melting, and running off basically a permafrost bed, and rising very, very quickly to peak. And then the other peaks are just rain squalls through the summer, and then it drops off again and recedes back down to the winter low. And here you're looking at a difference between winter and summer flows of 1/250. So anyone putting a dam on the Porcupine River would have to think a great deal about storage to cover that extreme winter low. And it's just at that time of year when everyone wants electricity. Just to show you that while we're looking at those, this is the Peel River, which is also a fairly high latitude. It has a basically permafrost regime. The same sort of thing as the Porcupine. Pelly River is here somewhere. But we actually study the Pelly at three locations, so they're superimposed. But there's the Pelly. It's the middle one, actually. The Pelly at Pelly Crossing, which is the Granite Canyon site, basically. It goes very, very low, and then during the snowmelt, rises and really drops gradually through the summer. Just intermittent rises due to rainfall. Goes right back down to the winter again. The Yukon River at Dawson and at Carmax and at the mouth of the White is somewhat flatter because you have the benefit of lake storage. So those are a sort of terrible hydrographs of the streams that we keep on hearing about. Now, how do we measure? How do we obtain a discharge? What the surveyor has to do when he gets to this station, using a boat, using the ice, using a cable car, whatever he can, he determines the cross-sectional area of the stream fairly precisely. This is quite a job in winter, because we have to cut 20 or 30 holes across the stream for each measurement. And when this is done in cold weather and with thick ice, you have a good day's work. He determines the cross-sectional area of the stream, and then with a number of different kinds of instruments, he records the velocity at each one of those verticals. The most used instrument is this thing, which is a current meter, a certain type of current meter, and then we have other types of current meters that are more suited for one type of condition than another. And the problem in winter is that when he, of course, takes this thing out of the first hole to move along to the next one, which may be 40 feet away, the thing becomes a block of ice. So we have to use special sleds which remain heated, throughout the entire operation. And these things have been designed here because we were the first office in North America to sort of go into this stream gauging process in a big way. We have designed much of the equipment that's being used today in Alaska and in across Canada. It's very odd here, some of it, but it works very well. And I only mention this to sort of indicate to you, to show you that while it does seem extremely simple, and it is simple in general terms, there are many problems. I'm going to show you just a few slides. I don't want to drag this out too long. Showing some of this equipment and a few installations. I really must apologize for the ones I have. I should have a lot more, but for about the first 15 years of my service, I was a black and white photographer, and I've ended up with a wonderful cabinet full of numerous negatives, and it's only now that I regret not having had good slides or something that could be shown to other people more readily. So I think I will go into showing you some of the equipment that we're using, and if there are any questions you want to ask me about any part of this kind of survey, I'd be happy to please to answer. And perhaps I should mention before I show these is that in order to obtain a very reasonably accurate
determination of discharge, we believe that all our discharges are within 5% being precise. And in order to sort of maintain this accuracy, we have to take many observations and mean them. This means this is a very laborious process. This one thing that you need for this kind of operation, for to do this kind of job, is patience. Particularly when, after going through, after cutting these 20 or 30 holes through 4 feet of ice, you find that underneath the ice, and this is not an uncommon condition in Yukon, there's 20 feet of packed slush ice hanging underneath. And you have to get your instruments, not only this thing, but a big sounding weight affair, through this slush ice. This is one devil of a job. So that in order to do, I keep repeating myself, very simple operation, there are many, many obstacles. Okay, I'll show you some photos, and then perhaps that may lead you to think of some of my questions. Hopefully I can answer.